This is not going to be part of our Romans series, so if you're looking forward to Romans, you're going to have to wait one more week. We wanted to give a break from Romans. Today we're going to talk about a little bit of a New Year's resolution that I have to give you a little bit of a setup here. Was it a week or two? About 2 weeks ago, we went and saw Natalie Grant at East Hill, and she had a moment where she was sharing some Bible verses, and this chapter came up. It is Psalm 77. So let's go ahead and open up to Psalm chapter 77. I'm going to read the whole thing, but don't feel like I'm going to spend a whole lot of time on each verse, and don't get worried about that too much. This should be a fairly short message, hopefully. Psalm 77, comfort in trouble from recalling God's mighty deeds is the title of this. Obviously, it was added by man later after it had been translated and whatnot. But what was actually in the original is this next part. It says, for the choir director, according to Jeduthun, I'm not sure how he pronounced his name, a psalm of Asaph, or Asaph, maybe. Okay, verse 1. My voice rises to God, and I will cry aloud. My voice rises to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. In the night, my hand was stretched out without weariness. My soul refused to be comforted. When I remember God, then I am disturbed. When I sigh, then my spirit grows faint. You have held my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of long ago. I remember my song in the night. I will meditate with my heart, and my spirit ponders. Verse 7, will the Lord reject me forever? And will he never be favorable again? Has his loving kindness ceased forever? Has his promise come to an end forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious, or has he in anger withdrawn his compassion? Then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. Verse 11, I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds. Your way, O Lord, or O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? Sorry, you are the God who works wonders. You have made known your strength among the peoples. You have, by your mighty power, redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound around, your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Verse 19, your way was in the sea, and your paths in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. All right, there's a lot of stuff here, and I'm going to spend most of the time on the first 10 verses and then kind of see how the chapter shifts drastically after that. So I want you to notice the intro first, which I pointed out to you a minute ago. This is a song that is being led by a choir director, Jeduthun. I'm not sure exactly if that's how he pronounced it, but it's a choir director that apparently King David had recognized within his order of the monarchy of some sort. He had actual choir directors who were there. And the song was written by a guy named Asaph. This song starts with a tremendous amount of introspection. It's complete self-centered. The focus is completely inward and on the person. The first 10 verses are really all about searching yourself. Let's start out with verses 1 through 3. My voice rises to God and I will cry aloud. My voice rises to God and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. In the night, my hand was stretched out without weariness. My soul refused to be comforted. When I remember God, then I am disturbed. When I sigh, then my spirit grows faint. So the first three verses, and then of course after that, we have a word called Selah or Selah, which actually is not the actual, the idea of this is that it's in the context of a song. And in the context of a song, it's really an interlude that's supposed to be there to help you reflect. So being a music nerd, I kind of have to listen or look at it in terms of this is a music instrumental breakdown where you're just meant to think about what he just said. So the idea is that there's a part that you're all singing or somebody is singing, and then he says something like, remember, which is what he says in verse 3, I will remember God, and then I am disturbed. When I sigh, then my spirit grows faint. Think about that. And then the music continues in the background. But no singing, because you're supposed to stop and think about what was just said, right? So it's a music interlude, a musical interlude portion of the song. And he says, this is what he remembers in verse 3. This is the first time he uses the word remember. He uses it quite a bit, I think five or six times in this section. Verses 1 through 6, I've kind of, not that it was me who came up with this, but I'm going to kind of label it as sighing. Because he says in verse 3, he says, when I remembered God, then I am disturbed. When I sigh, it seems like this whole verses 1 through 6 is all, you can kind of characterize it as a big sigh. He's sighing. And then you go in verse 4 and he says, you have held my eyelids open. He's accusing God of his insomnia, like it's God's fault, right? You have held my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. So verse 4, you see that he can't even talk, really. He's so tired that he can't talk. I cannot speak. Verse 5, let's stop for a second here. After reading the whole chapter, or at least the first half of it, you could pretty much say that there's a certain amount of drama that's in Asaph's life to write something like this. We all have a certain amount of drama that makes these verses kind of a reality in our lives at certain different seasons within our lifetime. You could look at these verses and go, wow, that totally describes where I'm at right now, or where I was 3 years ago, or where I was 20 years ago. You can, each one of us can look at this and go, yep, I've been there. If you've lived any amount of life as an adult, you can say, yep, I've been in this guy's shoes. I've been exactly where he's at. Maybe it was a family situation. Maybe it was a work situation. Maybe it was a financial situation where you're like, I can't even fall asleep anymore because this worry is stressing me out. Maybe it was another thing. Maybe it was an addiction to alcohol or drugs. Asaph is at a point in his life right now as he's writing this, or maybe he was reflecting upon it, where he is basically down and out. We would call this being down and out. He has hit a lot of trouble. He's miserable. He's hit rock bottom. All of us, at some point or another, after living some life, can relate to this. We've all been down and out. We've all hit rock bottom, or at least feel like we've hit rock bottom at times. I want you to notice his focus. Verses 1 through 10, his focus is completely on himself. He blames God for a few things, but the major focus is on himself. He mentions God, but usually it's out of reaction to how bad his life really is. So I have a question, because I'm pretty sure I can answer this for me, maybe for most of you. Have you ever approached God like this? Why are you doing this to me? What have you done to me? It's your fault. This is your will that I'm miserable. After reflecting upon you, yourself, your inward feelings, you react with a poor reaction towards God. When it's all about me and how miserable my life is, it's like a pity party, it becomes a never-ending cycle of woe is me, it must be God's fault. Woe is my situation, how miserable I am, it must be God's fault. And that whole thinking, that thought process becomes a cycle of misery and depression. In this cycle, you feel miserable, you start to blame God. As Asaph stops to think about his situation, he becomes more depressed and more strongly accusing God of this stuff happening in his life. In verse 4, let's read that again. You have held my eyelids open, like it was his fault that he had insomnia, like I mentioned before. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Apparently has led to some sort of loss of speech. Maybe it's because he's so tired. Verse 5, he says, I have considered the days of old, the years of long ago. So he starts to compare. This is the worst. You're comparing things to how things used to be. Right? Have you ever been in this cycle where you're like, well, it used to be so much better because whatever that was there, whatever that thing that was there, maybe it was a person, maybe it was a work situation. You start comparing your present life, your current life with your past, and you go, I don't like this situation. It must be God's fault. Comparing yourself to the way things used to be is another part of this cycle. Verse 6, I will remember my song in the night. I will meditate with my... Notice he says my song in the night. I will meditate with my heart and my spirit ponders. Again, here's that word of remembering. This time he's singing his woes. He's remembering his song, his woes. It sounds like an old blues song from maybe Chicago. I don't know, maybe in the South. I was thinking about Robert Johnson, the old blues singer, writer, guy who played guitar. You know, he ain't got nothing on Asaph, right? This is a pretty bluesy, low song, right? I'm living woeful, you know? Robert Johnson could have probably copied these lyrics and had a hit song. He didn't have hit songs when he was alive, but nonetheless. The more he focuses on himself and his own situation, the more he compares his current state to his past state, the worse it gets. It's a cycle that just keeps going down. Verse 6 almost sounds like he's looking for the answer within himself. He says, I will remember my song in the night. I will meditate with my heart, and my spirit ponders. It's all about me. I call this section sighing. Verses 1 through 6, and it's not me who came up with that. That's a common theological breakdown from different theologians and commentators. There's going to be four different sections, but not section 1 is 1 through 6, and it is basically categorized with sighing. We're going to talk about this meditating in the night later, but I want you to remember that in verse 6. I will meditate with my heart as he's remembering his song at night and his spirit is pondering. In verse 6. All right, verses 7 through 10. Let's read those. And the Lord, will the Lord reject forever? And will he never be favorable again? Has his loving kindness ceased forever? Has his promise come to an end forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Or has he in anger withdrawn his compassion? Like, did he willingly withdraw his compassion, or did he just forget about me, is basically my paraphrase for verse 9. Verse 10, then he said, it is my grief that the right hand of God, or of the Most High, has changed. Now he's saying that God has changed. Whew, okay. Here we see a rapid fire of different questions. He's got questions, he wants answers, right? This is Asaph just going, boom, boom, boom. I've got all these questions for you. Number one, first, has he rejected me forever? Has God rejected me? Question number 2 and 3 is, did God stop loving me, basically? We see that in the end of verse 7. Will he never be favorable again? Have I completely fallen out of favor with God? And in verse 8, has his loving kindness ceased forever? Like, is it completely gone? The fourth question is, has God scrapped his promise to me? Has God just completely done away with his promises to me? Are they no longer applicable to me? Did he forget about me, or did he just withdraw his compassion from me? And then the fifth question is, has God forgotten about him or angry with him? These are questions that we've probably all experienced in our life, at least to some degree or another. At some point, we've all asked these questions. Has God forgotten about me? Has God turned his back on me? Has God completely taken away the promises that he has for my life? And we see a break in the music again, the Selah, or interlude, or pause. This is the lowest part of the song right here. It's like the bridge where everything just goes downhill, right? Old B.B. King song or something, right? And he says in verse 10, He says this. He says, "Then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed." He's claiming that none of this is his fault. It's all God's fault. God's the one who changed. I didn't change. It's God's fault. He's laying all of the blame of his depression, his awful misery, on God's doorstep. And he's saying, it's all God. It's not me. It's God. Talk about a blues song. Okay. He blames his grief, his heartache, his sorrow on a change in God. Maybe God's attitude might be a little bit better towards him. It's all God's fault. The cycle of self-pity and looking within to find the answers will lead to blaming God and sinking lower and lower and lower. And I'm going to call this section, section 7 through 10, sinking. If you haven't noticed yet, both of those words start with S. There's sighing. Second is sinking. There's a theme going on here. They're all S words. All right, so this is the sinking, lower and lower. It's a terrible cycle to get caught up in. And I've got family members, I've got friends who are in this cycle of misery, and they're searching for answers within and doing nothing but giving God the blame. It's a cycle that just keeps going down and down. Now, this is where drastic change happens in this chapter, which is good, because if it would have ended like that, we would have been in misery. It's a drastic change in the focus and the tone of the psalm, and I bet you you'll be able to see it right off the bat. Verse 11, "I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work." A little different meditation there. We'll talk about that in a minute here. "And muse on your deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God?" Let's stop there. So Asaph turns his self-reflection upward. He changes from looking inward to looking upward. Now he's looking towards God. First thing he does is in verse 11, "I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old." Now, if you need help remembering anything that God has done, there are ways that you can instigate your memory perk up your memory. But one of the ways that that Asaph does it is he looks at things that God has done in the past that would be historical things that God had done in the past. He talks about the deliverance from Egypt. He talks about creation, the promises of Israel. He talked about Joseph and David. Many, many, many things that God has done that are wonders from long ago. And if you need help remembering any of those things, go back in Scripture and start reading the Old Testament or the New Testament. Read anything in Scripture that points you to what awesome things God has done. So you can see that he's, instead of looking inward, he's looking upward now. And the first thing he does is remember the things that God has done. Remember the wonders of old. And there's a laundry list of things you could go through. He does mention creation, like I said, deliverance from Egypt, the promises to Israel, to Joseph, David. And he actually kind of does it in a poetic way. So we've gone from Robert Johnson to maybe Bob Dylan, I don't know. This is much more poetic than Bob Dylan, though. I'll put it that way. All right, verse 12. "I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds." Now, this one is clear application right here for it. If you're looking for application, I want you to listen, read this verse one more time. It is, "I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds." If you are in that cycle going downward, spiraling out of control in depression and anxiety and misery, think about God. Think about the things he has done, the mighty works he has done. Meditate on those things. Now, I started thinking about the word meditate, and I have to be honest with you, this is a long story, so I'll cut it real short. I have been finding, in this building, I've been finding, I call them caches of tapes. Basically boxes or bags or just piles of tapes that are recorded messages from decades in the past when we would just record things with tapes. And I have found a considerable amount of them for my Uncle Arden, who died about 8 years ago now. And I have been holding on to them for years and collecting them for years, because with the intention of converting them over to digital and putting them on the church website, the part of the podcasting thing, so that people could listen to them. And I have not done that because it takes a lot of work to get the tape deck and plug it into the recording, the computer digital stuff, and getting that whole thing set up, and then getting all of the stuff. It's a lot of work, and part of it is just I was busy with other stuff. So I decided the other day I was going to do the first one. So I went out to the garage, got the tape deck, old school, put it in, you know, in the studio, and plugged it all in, and I started listening to a message from 23 years ago. It was January 5th, 1997. So almost 23 years ago. To next week, actually, it would be the first Sunday of 1997. I was a little younger back then. And I sat and listened to the whole thing, you know, listening to him preach. He was great. His voice, you know, just hearing his voice was nice. One of the things he said was, he talked about meditating. And meditating, you can meditate on things that are good, and you can meditate on things that are not good. And one of the things that he said is, we have a common tendency to think about it, things that make us worry. And worry is really meditating. It's constantly thinking about bad things, usually things we don't have control over. So worry is really the bad type of meditation. This is not my point. This was his point. I don't know where he got it from, and maybe he came up with it himself. I don't know. He was a pretty smart guy. But his point was that if you are worrying about stuff, it's because you're meditating on the wrong stuff. You're worrying, you're meditating on things that you have no control over and things that are negative. They're bad. And the opposite of that is meditating on things that are good. And so I think when Asaph, the guy who wrote this song, the guy who credited, or maybe it was a girl, who knows, who wrote this song, Asaph was, he mentioned meditation of his negative stuff, and now he's mentioning meditation of his positive stuff. He says, I meditate at night in this horrible cycle of misery and depression. Now I'm going to meditate on your works, God. So there's two types of meditation, healthy and negative, and the negative is what leads to worry, and you can't do anything to get out of that except for stop meditating on those things. Meditating is just thinking about something simple, something that's not hugely... I'll give you an example. If your goal is in reading scripture is to read 10 chapters a day, that's a lot of chapters. You're not going to be able to get a lot of the small details if you're just reading through it. Meditating is taking maybe a verse, maybe a phrase within a verse, and thinking about that for an extended period of time and letting it marinate in your mind. You can think about an event, maybe creating. Val and Joan like to say, and then he created the stars, right?
He created the stars also.
He created the stars also.
The biggest understatement in the world.
It's a small phrase. You could meditate on that for about 10 hours and still not figure the whole thing out, right? Mm-hmm. And he created the stars also. That's a perfect example of something that's small but humongous, right? And you can find that anywhere in scripture. The idea is to think, to find something that just strikes you as being amazing, a wonder of God, and marinate on it, meditate on it, let it sink in. Think about it for more than just 30 seconds. Or more than just a minute. Think about it for hours. Think about it that whole day. And that's what Asaph is saying to do in verse 11. In verse 12, I will meditate on all your work. You want to get out of that cycle of depression, being flushed down a toilet or something, and just being miserable and descending and more and more and more? Start thinking about God. Don't think about your miserable, awful situation. Think about God and the great things he's done. I will muse on your deeds, he says in verse 12. When you change your focus from within to heavenward, you naturally come to the conclusion that God is great. Go to verse 13. He says this, your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? Wow, this is a little different than saying it's all your fault, God. You're the one who's changed. Now he's saying, okay, our God is great. There isn't any others that are great like him. New Year's resolution. It's almost here. So my New Year's resolution for you and for myself, here it is. In times of trouble, take a pause, a musical interlude if you're thinking of your life as a musical, which most people don't, but take a pause for the musical interlude in the background to make you think, right? Because if this is a song, that's what in the context of a song, that's what he's doing. He's letting the instruments take over while he stops and pauses. When you have times of trouble, take a pause and think about all the great things that God has done. Don't look inward. Don't do the pity party thing. Look upward. Don't look inward. Look upward. And this is hard because our first reaction when something goes down, our first reaction is, ugh, why does this always happen to me? And then you start the whole pity party that Asaph started with in this chapter. But when you take a moment to reflect and go, God is so great. He did such and such, and he did that, and he did that, and he did that. And you start meditating on that rather than meditating on the stuff that you have no control over. It'll change your perspective from inward to upward. Most psychologists are missing this point because they think you got all the answers within. Yeah, Asaph had all the answers within and it made him miserable. Don't look in, look up. That's my New Year's resolution for myself and for us. Don't look inward, look upward. Verses 14 and 15 we'll go through real quick here. You are the God who works wonders and have made known your strength among the peoples. You have by your power redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. Asaph has broken out into full-blown worship. This is it. This is, look at all the things that God has done. Did you notice that there is no mention of himself at this point? The whole first part of this chapter was, woe is me, woe is me, woe is me, I'm at woe. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And then the last half of the chapter is no mention of me. The whole thing at the end is that it's all about God. It's all pointing to the worth of God. He specifically mentions God's redemption from Egypt. William MacDonald said it like this. The personal pronouns have disappeared, meaning me, I, that kind of stuff. The personal pronouns have disappeared entirely from his vocabulary. Self-centeredness has given way to God-centeredness. That was William MacDonald who said that. All right, so we've had sighing and sinking, and now we've got singing. Verses 11 through 15, I categorize this section as singing because he's basically, in the form of a song, he's worshiping God. Singing of the excellent things, the awesome works that God has done. And I think that that's a good S word that kind of summarizes that as singing. Now, verses 16 through 20, as we go through quickly here. Let's see. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, and your paths in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. This is referring to the Exodus, I think most of it, if not all of it. It's the Red Sea overtaking. I think it's a poetic way of saying the Red Sea has overtaken the Egyptians. He parted it, obviously, for the Israelites to get through, created the path, and then everything came down on the Egyptians. Interesting point that William MacDonald brought up is that he said it was he who opened a path so his people could cross dry land, yet no one saw his footprints. This is alluded to in this chapter. As is often the case, there were abundant evidences of his presence and power, though he himself was concealed in the shadows. So a lot of times in our lives, we see the evidence of God. We might not see his footprints, but we see the evidence that he was there. He might be in the shadows, invisible, you know, unseeable, but his effects, the evidence of him being there, is all around you. He's sustaining us. Now, verses 16 through 20 is categorized by the word soaring. I'm not sure why they came up with this word other than it's an S word and it kind of rhymes with everything else, kind of goes along with the scheme here. This is by far the happiest living that you could have. It's the end of worry. It's the end of sorrow. It's the end of depression, the end of misery. It's when you take focus off of yourself and you put it on God. I want you to think about the beginning of this. It's quite a drastic change that Asaph goes through. He was clearly probably a candidate for a psychiatric ward at the beginning of this, at least a Chicago's mid-century blues club, since this is in the form of music, or the South, depending on which era you want to talk about. But it's clear that Asaph is going through a lot of troubles. And I can relate to this. I've shared with you before, some of my students, I can't get into specifics. I'm not supposed to get into specifics about individual students, but many of my students are going through this cycle. They're in middle school. They don't know any better. And of course, the psychology is teaching them to look within, to find the light within, and there is no other God out there. There's no rhyme or reason to life. You were evolved from something, and you were kind of a accident or, you know, happened through chance. And they don't have any idea, because the schools won't allow us to teach them, and that there's something greater out there who's done amazing things, who's created each one of them for a purpose and a reason. So they're spiraling on this cycle that Asaph was on, looking inward, going, this is miserable. So instead of dealing with it in a positive way, we crank them full of Ritalin and all these other drugs that are not healthy for them either, and 20 or 30 years we'll be suffering the consequences of that, probably, that we don't know of now. They're unknown now. But Asaph was a psychiatric mess. He was much like the students at my school. He's a lot like some of us. Many of us are like that. But by the end of the psalm, he was calm. He was worshiping God. He was over the misery and depression that he was in at the beginning. Two takeaways. Here's my New Year's resolution for us all. There are two takeaways. First, remember to pause. Something bad happens to you, which it's going to happen probably today, maybe even. Somebody cuts you off. That's my infamous one. Man, poor drivers is a trigger of mine. Maybe some of yours too. Take a pause. Think about this as an instrumental interlude in the musical of your life. That's kind of what Asaph, you know, in the form of a song, he's basically saying, pause, let the instruments take over for a minute, and think about what you just sang or what you just heard somebody sing. If you were to stop and take a breath in stressful times, we will be able to respond to things in a lot better way. And our outlook would be a lot more positive than it probably already is at this point. Clearing our minds is important to good decision making and a healthy state of mind. Pausing, clearing your mind, taking a breath, let the instruments play in the background, maybe only in your head, but taking that time. The second thing I want you to think about, the second part of this, is to look upward. Think upward, not inward. If you think inward, that's what leads to that cycle of, oh, woe is me, and blaming God. Woe is me, blaming God. And it just keeps spiraling down and down and down to a deeper level of depression. Think upward, not inward. The answer is not found within. I'll be the first one to tell you. The answer is not found within. It's found up. And I'm going to leave you with one last, I don't know if it's not a proverb that I can remember in scripture, but it's an old saying that might give you some help. Occupation with self brings distress. Occupation with others brings discouragement. Occupation with Christ brings delight.